Chapter 6. Is Chinese Culture Modern? In 1915, the response of radical intellectuals to the fear that President Yuan Shikai would declare himself a new emperor was to propose the idea of a new culture. The same language, but a very different argument, was used by Mao during the Cultural Revolution more than half a century later. The idea that somehow China's culture had contributed to its uneasiness with the modern world has persisted from the time of the Opium Wars up to the present day. Yet contemporary Chinese writers are translated and praised around the world, their films win prizes at international film festivals, and Chinese artists command huge prices at auction in the global art market. The quest for a culture that is simultaneously modern, but also derived from Chinese desires and inspirations, continues to be at the center of the Chinese artistic endeavor. The origins of modern readership. Writing has, from the earliest times, been valued in Chinese culture. For centuries, reading remained a largely elite and male skill. An important part of the modernization of Chinese literature was its engagement with a mass audience and its use of technology to reach that audience. In this process, the Ming Dynasty was important because it saw an immense rise in the consumption of high and popular culture. China was at peace and became more prosperous, and this fact allowed a market for education, as well as for luxury goods and services, to emerge. In addition, new technology allowed particular types of product to develop, such as woodblock prints and popular novels, which could now be printed in huge numbers. The Jesuit monk Matteo Ricci, in the 17th century, noted the care and skill involved in creating a woodblock, observing that a skilled printer could make some 1,500 copies in a single day. The High Ming and Qing dynasties saw an interest also in connoisseurship, as well as mass-produced culture. The city of Yangzhou, in particular, became known during the Ming as a center where the people, by local custom, value scholarship and refinement, and the gentry promote literary production. See figure 11. In addition to a love of fine books, calligraphy, and painting, the cultivation of rare plants and acquisition of exotic fruits could be a sign of taste. Such connoisseurship would decline with the economic crisis of the late Qing, and the collective politics and ideologically and militarily driven austerity of much of the 20th century also frowned on the cultivation of such luxurious tastes. Only in the 1990s did the depoliticized consumerist urban economy in China once again encourage personal collections of art. The end of the imperial era also proved a watershed for both high and popular culture in China. Perhaps the most notable change in Chinese written culture in the early 20th century was the language reform of the 1910s and 1920s. In the late imperial era, classical Chinese was still used for official documents and works of literature and history, but the spoken language had developed over centuries since the classical form was used, and popular writing, such as novels, plays, and unrespectable writing, such as pornography, were instead written in a vernacular form of Chinese that reflected the spoken language. By the early 20th century, many reformers felt that it would not be possible for China to progress unless its written language was brought into harmony with its spoken form. Hu Xie, who'd studied in the US and then took up a teaching position at Peking University, was particularly instrumental in this movement. Despite China's disunited state in the 1910s, the language reform movement was highly successful. At the time of the 1911 revolution, it was still normal for newspapers and school texts to be in a simplified form of the classical language. By the mid-1920s, it was the Baihua vernacular form which had supplanted it almost entirely. This change also had a major impact on Chinese literature, which was almost entirely written in vernacular Chinese by the late 1920s. It's hard to overestimate the change made by this shift in Chinese culture. The arrival of an officially recognized vernacular form of written Chinese paved the way for mass literacy and the ability of the state to use education and propaganda to engage with its population, most notably under the CCP. May 4th and its critics. The interwar years have come to be regarded as the single most important period in the development of modern Chinese literature. The era is sometimes characterized as the May 4th period, a reference to the patriotic outburst that emerged in protest at the Treaty of Versailles, Chapter 2, and fueled a powerful rethinking that became known as the New Culture. The literature of the New Culture period is notable for its tone of constant crisis. It was the product of a China influx. The New Republic was less than a dozen years old, yet had already fallen victim to warlordism. Chinese society was still racked by poverty, and men and women were trying to find new ways to relate to each other. The writers used their fiction to deal with the pressing problems of a China trying to come into modernity. Many of these authors, including Lao Xu, Lu Xun, and Jiang Zhongxu, lived and worked abroad and brought global influences into their work. The writer even now generally considered to be modern China's finest was Lu Xun, the pen name of Zhou Xuren. Lu Xun's earliest short stories are notable for their savage condemnation of what he saw as the nature of Chinese society, inward-looking, selfish, and self-deluding. In The True Story of R.Q., the anti-hero, R.Q., is beaten up by his employers, rejected in love, and eventually wrongly accused of a robbery and executed. But all the time, even on his way to his death, he's convinced that he's making great progress in life. R.Q. is a Chinese everyman, but rather than a sympathetic little man fighting against greater forces, Lu Xun makes it clear that R.Q. is a petty and vainglorious jackanapes, whose problems are of his own making, a clear metaphor for the Chinese people as a whole suffering under warlords and foreign imperialists. During the 1911 revolution, R.Q.'s thoughts are all about the revenge that becoming a revolutionary will enable him to take on his enemies. All the villagers, the whole lousy lot, would kneel down and plead, "R.Q., spare us." But who would listen to them? The first to die would be Young D and Mr. Zhao. I would go straight in and open the cases. Silver ingots, foreign coins, foreign calico jackets. Another famous story, Diary of a Madman, points the finger of blame for China's crisis even more explicitly. The story concerns a young man who goes mad and becomes convinced that his friends and family are cannibals who are trying to eat him. Eventually, he consults a book about Confucian virtue and morality, only to find that, between the lines, the real text reads, "Eat people." None too subtly, Lu Xun's message was that China's traditional culture was a cannibalistic, destructive monster. These stories, still read by every school student in China today, cemented Lu Xun's reputation as an anti-Confucian voice for whom the modernization of China could not come too soon. While Lu Xun's later writing takes a more ambivalent tone towards the past, particularly as China's present became more intolerable, he never lost his sense of anger that his country had become engulfed in such difficult times. On the other hand, Lu Xun's writings are less clear about what form a China which rejected its Confucian past should take. Different versions of modernity are visible in other writers of the time. Mao Dun, the pseudonym of the writer Shun Yang Bing, wrote one of the finest evocations of urban modernity in Midnight, the opening scene of which describes Shanghai as a city lit up by neon, and the harbour of which is dominated by a huge advertisement beaming out the words "light, heat, power," seemingly describing not just the product advertised, but the city itself. For anyone who's seen the new Shanghai, which has grown up since 1990, this will seem a familiar scene. Today's skyscrapers and neon lights, absent for more than half a century after the communists' rise to power, would also strike a chord with anyone who knew Mao Dun's city. Mao Dun's Shanghai was glamorous but ruinous. The protagonists of Midnight gamble on the stock market and finally lose everything. A different aspect of modernity informed the work of Ding Ling, the pseudonym of Jiang Bingju. Still the most famous woman writer of modern China, Ding Ling made her name with a novella, The Diary of Miss Sophie, which discussed, in unprecedentedly frank style, the sexual longings of a young woman. Even Sophie's name was a gesture towards a modern internationalism. Not a usual name for a Chinese, Sophie brought to mind Sofia Perovskaya, the Russian anarchist revolutionary who tried to assassinate Tsar Nicholas II. Sophie is deeply dissatisfied with her own life, recovering from tuberculosis in Beijing, and is deliberately cruel to her friends to drive them away. Yet she burns with desire for a handsome young man, confiding to her diary, "I can't control the surges of wild emotion, and I lie on this bed of nails of passion." Again, the contradictions expressed by Sophie were symbolic of a wider crisis that affected young, urban women in China. New freedoms were opened to them, but how were they to make use of them? Sophie's dilemmas, of course, were very much those of the relatively privileged and educated minority dwelling in China's cities. The plight of the working classes was tackled by another major writer of the era, Lao Xu, in his novel Camel Jian Xu, translated as Rickshaw. The protagonist, Jian Xu, an ironic name that literally means fortunate, tries to get together enough money for his own rickshaw, but loses it all along with his fiancée, who's forced into prostitution and dies before he can rescue her. The novel ends with a broken Jian Xu picking up cigarette ends to eke out a miserable living. Lao Xu's portrayal of Jian Xu is far more sympathetic and humane than Lu Xun's savage caricature of R.Q., yet it is clear that Jian Xu, too, is meant to be an everyman, and by falling victim to individualism, the term Lao Xu uses to criticise him, he has contributed to his own downfall. Lao Xu later turned to science fiction to express this anxiety. In his 1933 novella, Cat Country, Mao Chung, his protagonist is a space traveller who arrives on Mars and finds that the inhabitants are all cats who spend their time fighting each other and eventually fall victim to an invasion of tiny people, clearly meant to be the Japanese. Lao Xu's extraterrestrial metaphor would have been understood by all the writers of the May 4th era, who believed that China's great crisis lay in its inability to realise that the nation was in mortal danger. For that reason, the now classic authors of the May 4th era read rather gloomily. Perhaps unsurprisingly, although they became well known, their books were not the real bestsellers of the era. That distinction goes to a rather different sort of novel, generically known as Mandarin Duck and Butterfly literature, referring to the traditional romantic fiction that had emerged and been widely circulated in late imperial times. These were escapist fantasies, with often stock characters, such as the martial arts knight errant, and a limited vocabulary which made them more accessible to a wider readership. Yet these novels too changed under the impact of modernity. The most successful author in the genre was Zhang Hengshui. His novel, Shanghai Express, draws on traditional fiction in its breezy, popular style and form, yet its characters are taken from the real, changing China of the 1920s. A new woman, dressed up in fancy Western clothes, a business tycoon, and a teacher, among others. Most importantly, it's set on a train, a powerful symbol of modernity, speed, and progress. His biggest hit, however, was the novel Fate in Tears and Laughter, a long and picaresque tale which narrated the decision of the hero to choose between two girlfriends, a traditional drum singer and a westernized bureaucrat's daughter who insists on being called Miss Helena, English style. The novel is full of hair-raising escapes, martial arts and wild romance, yet its central theme, the choice between tradition and modernity, is clear. Artists as well as writers tried out the new modern techniques of composition, often combining traditional Chinese art forms, such as the landscape, with modern themes. Perhaps the most famous of the artists to work in this hybrid style was Zhu Beihong, but other artists used techniques such as the modernist woodcut to develop a spare new style. The artist Feng Zikai became particularly noted for his skill in this genre. Yet art had also been a commercial enterprise for centuries. From the Ming to the late Qing, the techniques of reproduction that had allowed mass printing of books had also enabled visual images to be produced and sold for a market beyond the elites, and this market persisted and grew into the 20th century. Writers and artists under Mao and reform. The defining terms of artwork under Mao were set during the war years, when, in 1943, he delivered the Yan'an Talks on Art and Literature. Mao made it clear that, in the communist China that he envisaged, literature and art are subordinate to politics. It is therefore a particularly important task to help artists and writers overcome their shortcomings and win them over to the front that serves the masses of workers, peasants and soldiers. With the establishment of the People's Republic in 1949, a brief era of Soviet modernism took hold in China. Visual artists during the Mao years followed prescribed styles such as Soviet-influenced socialist realism and art drawn from folk traditions. The post-1949 years produced few novels of real distinction, Some key figures of the May 4th era, such as Lao Shi and Shen Zongwen, found it easier to write little or nothing at all. A brief period of openness came with the Hundred Flowers movement in 1957, when authors were given official permission to write as they saw fit. However, Mao became alarmed at the strong criticisms that were voiced and rapidly clamped down by starting the anti-rightist campaign, which flushed out hidden traitors who had supposedly used the opportunity of openness to attack the party. Many purged in the campaign, such as Ding Ling, were exiled for over a decade to the far northeast of China. A new period of creativity opened up in the 1980s and has continued since then, with a difficult period following Tiananmen in 1989. The contemporary literary scene in China operates in a grey zone. Many subjects are still taboo, but, as in the May 4th era, there is a certain amount of space for critical writing. Many of the best-known authors write with a jaundiced eye about modern China. Mo Yan, the pen name of Guan Moyue, has carved out a reputation as one of China's major contemporary novelists, a status cemented by his winning the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2012. His books include The Garlic Ballads, The Republic of Wine, and Big Breasts and Wide Hips, the latter of which attracted criticism because of its explicit sexuality and its lack of moral distinction between communists and nationalists during the Civil War. The book was for a time withdrawn in China after selling some 30,000 copies. Wang Shuo is another author who successfully negotiated the grey zones of cultural production in China with novels such as Please Don't Call Me Human and Playing for Thrills. Wang was a 1990s bestseller with over 20 novels published in China and a national reputation as a major writer. Yet his work was characterized as hooligan literature, Pijie Wenxue, for its nihilistic style and themes. The experiences of both writers show the ambiguities in contemporary censorship. It's quite common, as with Mo Yan's novel, for a book to be released officially, only to be banned later, or, as with much of Wang Shuo's work, for books to be condemned without ever officially being banned. At the same time, both Mo Yan and Wang Shuo continued to draw state salaries and were interviewed in the official press. The fact that these authors can publish daring work is in part a consequence of China's decision to open up again to the outside world. Wang Shuo and Mo Yan are now well-known international literary figures, and this has meant that even when their work is suppressed in China, they themselves remain free. Not all authors are anything like so fortunate, but the boundaries of censorship in China are flexible nonetheless. Along with writers, fine artists and musicians have negotiated a new bargain with the state since 1978. Their freedom to paint or play what they wish is much greater than under Mao. On the other hand, orchestras and artists were guaranteed a state income, like all other employees. Now they must operate under the same commercial constraints as any other entrepreneurs. Two of the most feted contemporary artists have both enjoyed commercial success, but under very different circumstances. Ai Weiwei is one of China's major contemporary artists, whose sculptures, such as sunflower seeds, are shown at major venues such as London's Tate Modern. Ai's political activism in favour of greater democracy and transparency has brought him into increasing confrontation with the Chinese authorities, with whom he's been in a cat-and-mouse situation since 2011, and who have brought against him a variety of charges, including tax evasion. In contrast, Xu Bing makes no ostensible statements about politics at all. Nonetheless, works such as Book from the Sky, which uses plausible-looking but actually non-existent Chinese characters, hints at the instability of language and meaning in a way that casts doubt on the brassy political certainties of contemporary China. Moving pictures. The 20th century also heralded a significant change in the way in which the Chinese told stories. Film, and later television. Film came swiftly to China, and by 1927 there were already over 100 cinemas in the country, the majority in Shanghai, the exemplar of Chinese modernity. Hollywood movies were immensely popular in the 1930s, but the Chinese also developed a powerful indigenous industry, again mainly centered on Shanghai. The wartime years reflected the splits within China itself, with patriotic films being produced in the nationalist areas, while filmmakers in Shanghai and Manchuria worked under Japanese occupation. However, like their French counterparts during the same period, it's possible to see hidden resistance to occupation within the latter films. After the victory over Japan, filmmakers also reflected the ambiguity of victory. In the 1947 film, A Spring River Flows East, the narrative unfolds to show that a family separated by war found that there was no happy reunion, as personal betrayals by family members echo wider ambiguities and betrayals in society about whether it had been better to flee westward in 1937 or stay behind under occupation. Filmmaking under Mao mostly reflected the propaganda requirements of the regime, and in the Cultural Revolution period, very few films were made at all. The reform era of the 1980s also marked the beginning of a new, powerful cinema, pioneered by a group who became known as the fifth generation of filmmakers, and whose filmmaking should be compared with the simultaneous glasnost, openness filmmaking, of directors such as L.M. Klimov, which emerged in Gorbachev's Soviet Union. Perhaps its single most prominent exponent was Zhang Yimou. Although many of Zhang's films were set in the pre-communist era and condemned feudal habits such as concubinage, they seemed to reflect an ambiguity about Chinese society in the present day as well, which was a long way from the fervent acclaim for New China that the regime's propagandists had portrayed. The closing frames of Judo shows a chaotic scene at a dye works with, symbolically, red paint spilling everywhere, adding to the mess. Scenes such as this led to some of Zhang's later films being banned from distribution within China itself, although they continued to win awards overseas. Other of Zhang's films, such as the story of Qi Ju, painted everyday life in rural China in a nuanced and ambiguous fashion. The local official who bullies Qi Ju's husband by kicking him in the testicles, leading her to try to sue him, also helps her give birth. The contradictions of Chinese modernity and life under a regime which was unsure of its own identity and purpose were refracted back through Zhang's pictures. Other directors of the era, including Cheng Kai-gyu, whose films Yellow Earth and Farewell My Concubine also cast a more quizzical eye on the reform era, had a difficult relationship with the censors, though in more recent years many of these directors' films, such as Zhang Yimou's Hero, have included stunning performances of traditional martial arts, using mass media further to publicise aspects of China's traditional culture. However, the boundaries of censorship were tested yet further by underground films, dealing with taboo subjects from homosexuality to tensions during the Cultural Revolution. These films rarely achieve a release in China, but can be seen in DVD form at private showings, increasing the scope of the grey zone of culture that is officially banned but still in circulation. Television only became widespread in China in the 1980s, although a limited service began as early as 1958. However, within a few years, China was rapidly developing the largest television audience in the world, and CCTV, China Central Television, took advantage of the thaw of the reform era to experiment. Many programs, particularly on news and current affairs, were, and are, weighty and heavy, with positive news intended to boost the party's reputation. More popular were the wide range of costume dramas that filled the screens, including series based on popular classics such as Outlaws of the Marsh and The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, as well as historical dramas based on both ancient and more recent events such as the Opium Wars. The power of television, however, was shown most clearly in the debate that surrounded the remarkable television series River Elegy, Hersheng. Hersheng. In June 1988, one of the most extraordinary programs in the history of television was broadcast on CCTV 1, the main Chinese station. It was repeated once, in August 1988. In the aftermath of Tiananmen Square in 1989, it was banned, and has remained so ever since. The people associated with making it were imprisoned, or fled into exile in Hong Kong or the West. The program was called Hersheng, usually translated as River Elegy or Death Song of the River. It was part documentary, part polemic. It consisted of six episodes which reviewed recent Chinese history to try and answer the question of why China was still so backward after a century or more in the modern world. It set out to provoke. Among its main targets were some of the most valued symbols of Chinese civilization, the Great Wall, the Dragon, and the Yellow River, the river of the title. Rather than regarding these as symbols of a proud and ancient culture, the filmmakers, including writers Su Xiaokong and Wang Lusheng, condemned them as examples of what held China back. The wall served to shut China off from the rest of the world, the dragon was a violent and aggressive creature, and the Yellow River was slow-moving, clogged up with silt, and enclosed within Chinese territory. The filmmakers made a symbolic contrast with the colour blue, the colour of the Pacific Ocean, from where the new spring water that would renew China will be found. The Pacific Ocean was not a particularly subtle reference to the US, scenes from which were shown throughout the programme. Stirring music accompanied footage of historical events, scientific breakthroughs, and even space exploration. The programme strongly endorsed the reform programme of CCP General Secretary Zhao Ziyang, yet it was not merely the expression of one set of views within the leadership. Instead, it had a powerful political agenda of its own, expressed in the line, "Many things in China, it seems, should return to May 4th. The May 4th movement of 1919, with its catchphrase that China needed science and democracy, was at the centre of the filmmakers' agenda. However, to say that the promise of May 4th had not been fulfilled was dangerous indeed. For the CCP itself drew its legitimacy from the fact that it had risen up during the May 4th era, and that Mao himself had taken part in the intellectual ferment of the time. The makers of Heshong made their agenda explicit at the very end of Episode 6. They declared that a dictatorial government was marked by secrecy, rule by an individual, and the fickleness of his temperament, whereas democracy was about transparency, responsive to popular will, and a scientific approach. The reference to conservative elements in the CCP and Mao's legacy was clear. The program created a craze. Discussions of it turned up in the newspapers, and letters were sent in their thousands to the television station. Even the bastions of party orthodoxy, such as the People's Daily newspaper, reprinted parts of the script and printed discussions relating to the series' message. The events of the 3rd to the 4th of June 1989 ended the thaw in public discussion of which Heshong had been one of the most important parts. In autumn 1989, a round table of major historians was put together to condemn Heshong as reactionary, full of historical errors, and unnecessarily abusive of the Chinese people. In retrospect, the programme does seem to be a historical piece in its almost naive enthusiasm about the power of Western thought to transform China. Yet the programme was an immensely daring attempt to take on old orthodoxies, but also to use China's past, the May 4th movement, to advocate an alternative path. Occasionally, television programmes have shaken an entire society. In the US, Roots forced the country to reconsider its legacy of slavery. In the UK, Kathy Come Home revealed that the lives of Britain's poor could be torn apart by homelessness. For China, there has never been, and may never be again, a television programme as serious, as compelling, as important as Heshong. River Elegy's condemnation of what it regarded as the outdated, inward-looking Chinese civilization daringly included Mao, the false peasant emperor, in the list of factors that had held China back. Hundreds of millions of Chinese may well have watched at least some of River Elegy's 6 episodes before it was banned in the aftermath of Tiananmen Square in 1989. Chinese television became more professional and more diverse in the 1990s and early 2000s, although it still remained strongly under the control of the state. It also became more internationalized. One notable example was China's contribution to the global craze for amateur singing competitions, shows such as Pop Idol in the UK and American Idol in the US. A television station based in Henan Province launched its own version in 2005, the full title being Mongolian Cow Sour Yogurt Supergirl Contest. 120,000 women took part, and the final was viewed by 400 million people, who eventually phoned in to support the 21-year-old Li Yuchuan from Sichuan as the winner with 3.5 million votes. See figure 12. The program was notable for many reasons. In one sense, Supergirl was probably the closest thing that China had had to a free nationwide election since 1912. Certainly, it was not well received by the official national broadcaster, China Central Television, CCTV, which declared the program vulgar and manipulative. The program was not rerun in its original form the following year, although CCTV's lack of enthusiasm for it may have been fueled as much by fear for their advertising revenues being sucked away by the regional competitor station as by political worries. Supergirl was also notable for how similar it was to other such contests around the world. In the post-Cold War era, the idea was often heard that politics had become almost irrelevant in the Western democracies, as there was little difference between right and left, and citizens had turned instead to materialist consumption and individual gratification. Supergirl suggested that this fear did not just exist in democracies. The idea of individual celebrity as a life goal was as far from the Maoist conception of the good life as could be imagined, and if it distracted young people from political dissent, so much the better, as far as the reform-era state was concerned. In a print advertisement, a line of popular clothing was advertised with the blatantly anti-Maoist slogan, "Different from the masses." The culture of mass-produced individuality was in China to stay. Architecture and the modern city. Cultural forms changed around the Chinese over the 20th century, and one of the most visible of those changes, indicating the change from pre-modern to modern, was the way in which city planning changed forever. For centuries, Chinese cities were arranged on a predictable pattern. Travellers approaching a city would first see, from miles away, the huge grey brick walls that surrounded any settlement of size. Within the city's walls, the magistrates' yamen and bureaucratic offices would be at the centre, and commercial and residential areas would radiate out from that point. One of the first cities to violate this rule was Shanghai. Expanded as a treaty port, whose primary purpose was commerce, not government, the foreign-controlled international settlement area had a long shopping street, Nanking Road, at its centre, leading not to a government building, but to the racecourse. Although the imperialist presence was the source of great anger in China, it was also the example of modernity that was most obviously before people's eyes, and Chinese reformers signalled their own adherence to the norms of the modern city by reproducing them. So Canton's Great Walls were destroyed by the Chinese local administration in the 1920s, which was allied to the Nationalist Party, then still a regional rather than national power. In their place came commercial boulevards and highways. The nationalist government that took power under Chiang Kai-shek in 1928 had grand plans for their new capital at Nanjing. It would have arterial roads, tree-lined avenues, electric streetlights, and a palatial new party headquarters that combined features of the Temple of Heaven in Beijing and the US Capitol in Washington. Less than 10 years later, the nationalists had to withdraw from the capital, leaving most of this planning in the realms of the imagination. The war with Japan stopped most of the great building plans, and many cities were heavily bombed, destroying many old buildings and walls. But the single greatest period of change in China's cityscapes has been the era since 1949. The nationalists dreamed of using architecture as power. The communists achieved it. Very few of China's major cities today reflect the topography that the residents of 100 years ago would have known. All around China, from the 1950s, traditional city walls were knocked down, the winding alleyways of the inner cities were destroyed to make way for high-rise buildings, and old temples and government offices were bulldozed to make way for buildings, some in the Soviet Gothic wedding cake style, but more often in the bland language of the international modern. Much of the rejection of China's past that marked the Cultural Revolution, literature, philosophy, art, has been reversed since the 1980s, as the party and the people alike seek to rediscover their own heritage. This reversal has been far less evident in city planning and architecture. To this day, large sections of China's major cities resound with the noise of the wrecking ball and the jackhammer. A significant, if partial, exception is Shanghai. A good proportion of its old colonial architecture, particularly the parts in the city centre, have been carefully preserved and even sport heritage plaques giving details of their history. Ironically, the indigenous architecture of other cities is under greater threat. The decision to award the 2008 Olympics to the city was a great spur to building in Beijing, yet the frenzy of building work has almost all been at the expense of the older buildings of the city. The alleyways, Hutong, the oldest of which appeared in the Yuan dynasty, with their low-rise, courtyard-style living, have been daubed all over the city with the character Chai, meaning for demolition. The city has replaced them with tower blocks in the suburbs and sophisticated new buildings in the centre by international architects such as Rem Koolhaas and I.M. Pei. The authorities have given many reasons for the wholesale elimination of so much of old Beijing, citing in particular the unhygienic and impractical nature of the hutongs for contemporary living. Many such alleys had no running water in the houses, and the communal toilets were freezing in winter and unbearably close in summer. The old alleys of cities such as Chengdu and Kunming, charming if impractical for motor vehicles and modern plumbing, have also been raised in favour of skyscrapers and tower blocks. But the replacements often show little evidence of a Chinese flavour. In the early 20th century, the nationalists in Canton tried to show their modernity by adapting globalised, that is, Western, urban planning. That tendency is still evident for China's government in the early 21st. Globalising Chinese culture. China exists in a global cultural context. In the 20th century, it tended to absorb cultural norms above all, whether of modern literary genres, cinematic styles, or artistic and architectural techniques. However, there are signs that aspects of the trend are reversing, and China is beginning to project not just military and economic power, but also cultural strength, sometimes termed soft power. Cinema has helped here, through the popularity of films such as Zhang Yimou's martial arts extravaganzas. Chinese language learning has risen around the world, stimulated by a new perception of China's global importance. Furthermore, one should note the heavy influence of internationalism in the shaping of modern Chinese culture. Even in the most closed period of modern Chinese history, during Mao's rule, cultural models came from the USSR, and Marxist-Leninist ideas were widespread. In the period before 1949 and since 1978, a stunning variety of influences, from American management gurus to French philosophers to Mahatma Gandhi, have reshaped the Chinese sense of the modern self and the meaning of Chinese culture.